This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today we are back with a repeat guest because he's so good and I love following his work. We're talking to Jan Wolf. He's a legal affairs correspondent for Reuters. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for passing judgment with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Jan, you cover, among other things, the Supreme Court. And this week, there were oral arguments. They lasted almost 2.5 hours in a big voting rights case, which, as far as I can see, could have a huge legal and political impact. And I'd love to talk to you about this. I will super briefly kind of set the table, which is we're talking about a case coming out of Louisiana right after the census. Louisiana redrew their district maps, as everybody else does, as every other state does, and Black voters sued and said that their votes were diluted in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. A district court judge said, "We think you are more likely than not to succeed on your Section 2 claim." And so Louisiana went back and redrew district lines that now included not one, but two majority-minority, meaning two Black districts. Then white voters sued. They said you took race into account too much when you redrew those district lines. And in fact, you took race into account so much that it violates the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. That case then went up to the Supreme Court last term. The court kind of punted at the end of June and said, come back for re-argument. Jan, could you pick up on what changed in the case from when it was argued last term to this term? Did the questions presented change and did the parties' arguments change?
Yeah. Well, that was a really good summary of what, as you say, is a really complicated case procedurally. The court seemed to maybe just not be able to come to any sort of agreement. That does happen every now and then, where they just can't seem to cobble together a majority or a way to approach the case. And they brought it back for re-argument. And the question presented the second time around really goes much more to, is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act constitutional? And, you know, that's the part of the Voting Rights Act that is probably the most important, that broadly discriminates racial discrimination in voting and creates a private enforcement mechanism that, you know, has given rise to, you know, dozens of lawsuits that, you know, different liberal-leaning groups bring on behalf of Black voters. And I think that the way it went down really alarmed a lot of voting rights advocates, because it took what could have been sort of a run-of-the-mill case that didn't really have consequences beyond Louisiana into, you know, a full frontal potential attack on Section 2, which is also, I think, worrisome for voting rights advocates, because they remember well what happened in the Shelby County case 12 years ago, where the Supreme Court invalidated Section 5 about preclearance that basically required states with a history of discrimination to get federal approval for some changes to voting. And so they're worried about a repeat of that.
So right now, we have this landmark piece of civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act. But as you correctly said, really, we only have one half of it left, because there were two parts to the Voting Rights Act. There was Section 5, which basically said to some jurisdictions that have had problems with voting in the past, we don't trust you. So come and check in with the federal government before you make any changes to your voting practices or procedures. The formula to figure out who would be covered under Section 5 was invalidated. So that stands as kind of a hollow promise. It's not enforceable. So then what's left after Shelby County in 2013 is Section 2, which says that when it comes to voting practices and procedures, that you can't essentially dilute people's voting power on the basis of race or color or membership in a language minority. And Jan, could you tell us a little bit more? You said it's a full frontal attack on Section 2. So Section 2 does cover more than redistricting, although that's certainly where I think Section 2 does the majority of its work. But is there a possibility that the court could declare Section 2 invalid, or are we really talking about hobbling Section 2?
Well, I think it's more about hobbling. I think people use different verb choices, chip away, hollow out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think we are likely to get a ruling that says Section 2 is entirely invalid and unconstitutional. We could get something close to it. There's a group of, you know, like you say, white voters that have challenged this revised map that increased Black voting power, and they are backed by Louisiana Republicans. And they are advocating for a ruling that Section 2 is unconstitutional in the redistricting context, because it would require states to sort people based on race. It's sort of an extension of the Harvard case in affirmative action, where, you know, you have conservatives saying we need to get back to a colorblind constitution. We need to just take race out of districting like we've taken race out of college admissions. But I should point out that there's different ways the court could go. And the Justice Department has, I guess you would call it, a more nuanced approach than the other advocates. It wants the court to go back to a 1986 case that laid out a general test for how you approach these Section 2 cases and revise it. So it'd be one of these instances where the Supreme Court kind of overturns a precedent without actually explicitly saying it's doing so, would frame it more as revising that legal framework. And this framework would make it harder for plaintiffs to prevail. It would put new evidentiary burdens on them in Section 2 cases. Like, they'd have to present statistics that decouple race and party. Like, they would have to show that when a Republican legislature diluted Black voting power, they were actually doing that and not just diluting the voting power of Democrats. And of course, that's a challenge in a country where in more than 80% of the time, Black voters favor Democrats, right? So I think, having spoken to a few experts, there seems to be a consensus that's where we could be heading, where it's not a, you know, invalidation of Section 2 in a districting context so much as a new test that might sort of effectively gut it, or at least hobble it.
So that's really helpful to think about. I want to come back, I think, to this question of, you know, the affirmative action decision. That decision, of course, from June of 2023, where the Supreme Court said when it comes to admissions for colleges or universities, that you cannot take race into account as a factor in making your admissions decision. And the opinion by Chief Justice John Roberts said that basically the 14th Amendment requires that we not make those race conscious decisions, that we be colorblind. And so it's problematic to draw racial lines, even if you have, as the chief said in the opinion, commendable goals, that you cannot try and achieve those goals on the basis of drawing lines according to race. Jan, could we go back to, because you had a great explanation of what the Department of Justice is advocating. Could we go back to something that I found the justices went up and back in the oral argument, which is the difference between proving a Section 2 violation and providing the remedies for Section 2. So for proving a Section 2 violation, it seems to me that you have to, by definition, take race into account, because you're determining if people's votes are diluted on the basis of race. Is that in question at all?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the DOJ proposal would tweak the framework both in terms of liability and remedies. And so the criticism of it among a lot of academics, a lot of people on the left, is that it really is just gutting Section 2 without explicitly saying so. And I think we saw some colloquies from Justice Sotomayor saying as much, where she said, it just seems like you really actually just want to get rid of Section 2.
Right. And so what I've heard, and I think I hear you say this as well, that the DOJ's idea of how to change showing that there is a violation of Section 2 would really allow for essentially a partisan gerrymandering defense where you can say, I'm not drawing these lines to dilute people's ability to vote on the basis of race. I'm drawing these lines because I want this person of this party to win or to keep power. Do I have that about right in terms of the proposal on the liability side?
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, it would effectively make these cases about showing intentional bias. And that doesn't, according to many, really comply with what Congress has tried to accomplish when it's amended the Voting Rights Act on multiple occasions. One academic I've corresponded with in my reporting this week is Spencer Overton at George Washington. And his take is, and I'm quoting, if adopted, referring to the DOJ framework, quote, Section 2 cases would still exist on paper, but would be nearly impossible to win. Courts could dismiss claims before trial, giving state legislatures free rein to entrench their power and sideline voters of color.
So the DOJ proposal, which I do think a lot of people feel is, even if it's not in the middle of the two opposing views, it's more of a middle ground. I think what I hear you saying is that experts have said, okay, it would keep Section 2 on the books, but one, when Congress amended Section 2, they specifically said that we're looking at not just intentional discrimination, but discrimination based on the effects that lines can have on people's right to vote, and that the DOJ proposal would essentially make it incredibly difficult to successfully bring one of these Section 2 claims. But could you help me focus in on then what happens if you can? So let's say you can get past this incredibly difficult hurdle if the court decides to adopt that framework for Section 2 so that it's, I think I heard you use the words, virtually impossible to succeed on one of these claims. And I know you were quoting from Spencer Overton. What then happens in the second part? You can prove that there is a Section 2 violation. What are the available remedies then? Because I know a big part of this case is, can you take race into account in remedying a Section 2 violation?
Like you'd be able to in theory, get a new map approved in the courts that increases Black voting power, creates another majority minority district or whatever, right?
So it seems like what the DOJ would be proposing for the remedy side is to draw district lines, but certainly lines where race doesn't predominate as a factor, and maybe where race doesn't factor in at all. Do I have that potentially right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, okay, that's really helpful, Jan, in the sense of thinking about, because this is a complicated case. I mean, most cases I think you and I could do it, we'd be about 6 minutes in, we talk about this part, what this party's arguing, what that party's arguing. And this is a hard voting rights case because Section 2 in and of itself, I think, is somewhat complicated and potentially now open for reinterpretation. And there's questions of how exactly you prove that there's been a violation, that district lines have been drawn in a way that dilutes your right to vote. And then what do you do about that? What's the remedy? Could you help us think through oral arguments a little bit in the sense of when you were listening to the justices, I heard the liberal justices essentially say, don't make any changes to Section 2 because we just heard a case out of Alabama, the Milligan case, where we basically considered these questions and we decided to not to disturb any precedent or our interpretation of Section 2. Is that right, that the liberals seem to want the status quo?
The liberals want status quo. They point out that just 2 years ago in Allen versus Milligan, a case out of Alabama, the court declined an opportunity to revisit Section 2. And I think they're worried about the legitimacy of the court, how it's perceived by the public if just 2 years later it goes and takes a different approach. But on that, it did seem like the liberals were losing that battle from the start. I mean, you had Chief Justice Roberts, I think in the very first question, make clear that he saw that as a different case.
Yes.
And that he had some issues with the evidence in that case. And so I really felt like that was a really rough start for voting rights proponents. It signaled that he was open to revisiting Allen versus Milligan, and that was a 5-4 decision. So you just would need only him to switch sides.
And that was 5-4 with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh in the majority. As you noted, all you need is one of them to change their vote, and that is a different case. Did you perceive any splintering on the conservative side? I had a hard time articulating exactly where I think this case would go, other than to say, it does seem to me that what the Department of Justice put forward, this idea that it will be harder to prove a violation, and that if you do, that using race to remedy it could be a problem. I had a hard time articulating exactly where I thought the majority might be going. Did you hear possible paths there?
Well, I agree with you that there does seem to be some splintering among the conservatives. The obvious caveat, you know, this is just oral argument. They're just fleshing out different positions. But I look at Justice Gorsuch, and he seemed to, unlike Kavanaugh, raise a lot of issues with the DOJ approach about its workability, about, you know, whether we would just be taking one test, replacing it with a new one, and then having a bunch of cases to figure out what this new test means. And, you know, that's the thing I think lawyers often get knocked for, is they love a multi-factor test, and it just breeds more litigation and confusion in the end, right? So it is possible that we end up with enough splintering that, you know, you don't really get a majority. You just sort of get different pluralities, and it ends up becoming a narrow ruling after all. That would be the best potential outcome, I think, for the voting rights advocates before the court. So it is a bit of an open question how this one turns out. You know, I'm seeing a lot of predictions that, you know, the Voting Rights Act is on the chopping block. And, you know, we just talked about Allen versus Milligan. I mean, a lot of people thought that would be the case where the statute was gutted, and that didn't happen. We do need to be careful getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. There's a lot of ways the court could go in terms of off ramps. And so the question it really is, you know, how much does this decision just limit itself to Louisiana versus nationally?
Before we leave Louisiana, could you talk to us a little bit about what those off ramps might be?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me, and this is one that they probably didn't need to re-argue the case over, but I mean, they could just say that with regard to this particular map, partisan goals were clearly the guiding light here. You know, Louisiana's legislature has long said that they devised the map that came out in 2022 that had only one Black majority district to protect incumbents. I mean, Louisiana has some really powerful members of Congress, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and Steve Scalise as well. And that was also a big consideration in the 2024 map. So, you know, that is one potential off-ramp, is to really just narrow in on this particular map and say, you know, this was a case where partisan gerrymandering was at work. And we've already really, as a court, tried to extract ourselves from those cases. We've given carte blanche to do that. And then, so, you know, that would lead to a scenario where I think Louisiana goes back to the original map, a Black Democrat in Congress basically, you know, gets districted out, but it doesn't have the same kind of major ripple effects across the country.
That makes sense. I mean, as you pointed out, what happened last term could be just a failure to reach consensus. And what we could see this term is another failure to reach consensus and maybe a plurality opinion. I feel like there is a possibility that we see the words affirmed, or the, excuse me, I should say the word affirm, and then there's just this splintering of exactly what the court decides to say and how many members say it. Now, Jan, while I have you, because you do cover the Supreme Court as well, and I know that you've previewed the term and you've talked about how Trump's power, and in fact, executive power, is really going to be on the court's docket. Could you tell us a little bit more about some of the cases that we're going to see this term?
I would say I have identified two main themes on the docket. And the big one is executive power. I mean, it was already shaping up to be a big term about the limits of presidential authority. And then they added more blockbusters in the form of the case about whether Trump can fire Lisa Cook, one of the governors of the Fed, and obviously the tariffs case. And then we have yet another case about whether we can have independent agencies. And so that is a big theme. And I would say the other one is, I think we're seeing a real, for the second term in a row, a real return to big social issues like transgender rights and gay rights. And so we, you know, had an argument last week about whether Colorado can ban conversion therapy, you know, efforts to have people change their gender identity or sexual orientation. And that could end up being another case out of Colorado where, you know, you have a Democrat-backed law that gets struck down on First Amendment grounds. You know, like we've seen, that would be the third time we've, you know, seen two other cases about designing wedding cakes or websites for gay people getting married. And, you know, this could just be the next evolution in that. I mean, that's the prediction based on how that argument went, that you're going to get another 6-3 decision where the conservatives say this is overreach on a violation of the First Amendment because you're intruding on these counseling sessions and to put forward sort of an orthodox viewpoint about sexuality and gender identity. And what I'm really looking for this term, I think, along with really everybody, is when are they going to push back on Trump, right? I mean, there's an argument that the shadow docket, which has resulted in all these preliminary victories for Trump, is not really representative of what the justices actually feel because it's just, you know, this truncated schedule, there's no briefing. It's sort of like handpicking certain cases, and it doesn't mean that they're never going to rule against Trump. And so now's their opportunity. So, you know, is it going to be the tariffs case? Is it going to be birthright citizenship? You know, are they going to stand up to Trump? And that's what I think we're all waiting to see.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about all of those emergency docket or interim docket or shadow docket, however we want to define it, all of those rulings and figure out how many of them could be overturned. Because as you said, the justices don't have full briefing. They don't have full oral arguments. They just have this kind of bare bones question in a sense, and they don't give a rationale for their reasoning. So they're not forced to, just by virtue of what the shadow docket is, they're not forced to articulate what their reasons are. And of course, the Trump administration picks those cases where they think they're going to be most successful to go to the Supreme Court in the first place. So there's a little bit of a, I guess, for lack of a better way of describing it, kind of a denominator issue when it comes to the statistics of win-loss. But it will be fascinating to see whether or not in some cases where the justices did rule and grant the Trump administration a stay, if that changes when it gets to the merits docket. Jan, as we're winding down, I wanted to ask you if you're thinking about something I think about a little bit, which is the difference between decisions that a president makes that affects the executive branch and then decisions that the president makes that are outside of the executive branch. So maybe it's a immigration decision, maybe it's a decision based on tariffs. Do you see that there could be a potential division in the court based on maybe the idea that when the president decides to fire somebody who's head of an independent agency, that the president has the power to do that because the president's head of that branch. But then when the president moves out, and meaning out of the executive branch, and wants to do something like impose tariffs, that maybe that's where the president goes too far? Or am I just trying to organize and we just don't know yet?
You're onto something. I mean, one invokes much more of a separation of powers concern than the other. Like in the tariffs case, there's a question of, you know, is Trump finding power in a statute that simply doesn't exist? And now we're getting into real, at least what really should be core conservative, you know, thought about separation of powers. They have said, you know, when Biden was president, that we, you know, shouldn't let a president, you know, find in ambiguities in the law the ability to do these sweeping economic policies. And so, you know, a tariffs ruling in particular, I think, would really send a message that, you know, they're looking at this in a very principled way. I'm talking about a tariffs decision against Trump, obviously, looking at these issues in a really principled way, and that, you know, their doctrines, like the major questions doctrine, are applied even-handedly. And I think that is a very different calculus than when you're talking about something like the removal power, which is just much more uniquely, you know, within the realm of presidential authority without implicating Congress's power to nearly the same extent. Once you get into the appointment power, it's a little different, right? Because, I mean, we envision a system where there is a role for Congress, an important role for Congress to vet people and make sure that, you know, president isn't putting some lackey in charge. I mean, that, we also have all these end runs around that, which I think you're also seeing a lot of discussion of right now, that allow him to put interim and temporary appointments into pretty powerful positions in our government. But, you know, when it comes to can he fire the head of an agency, I think you're right that there's just a lot more reluctance there to intrude on presidential authority in an area like that. And so that might be sort of a dividing line. That might be one lesson we learn about presidential authority this term.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see on that. Jan, last question, which doesn't actually have to do with any of the cases, but you've been a legal affairs correspondent, reporter for a bit now. You're also a lawyer. I follow your work closely because it helps me understand everything that's happening in the world. I'm wondering if there's something that you wish people understood maybe better about what you do, or if you think people just really don't understand exactly what you do with your days, or if there's just something you wish people knew a bit more about what it is to be a legal reporter in America in 2025.
I think that there's just a challenge in writing about legal affairs because, especially for me, I work at a global newsroom, Reuters, and we have to write in a way that is accessible to your average person in, you know, Frankfurt or whatever. And we really can't presume too much knowledge about how our system works. So that can, I think, sometimes lead to just maybe not as much nuance as some of the lawyers would like to see. And that is, you know, just an attention in being a journalist is you have to write for the people who know nothing about a case and for the people who live and breathe the case. And just that it can be a real challenge to do both and please everybody. But, you know, that's also what I really enjoy about the job. And I think that's one thing you do really well is distilling these legal concepts into a way that makes them more accessible. And, you know, I think we both enjoy that challenge. And, you know, that's what kind of keeps it fun at the same time.
Well, I'm so glad that you're doing this. It's always fun to talk to you on and off the pod, and you really helped. I mean, we asked you for, I think, what I'm guessing will be the most complicated case this term, and you really helped me to think through the possibilities, what could happen, and of course, you know, there can always be a surprise when this case actually comes out, which you reminded us of as well. So Jan Wolf of Reuters, thank you so much again for your time.
Yeah, happy to come by and yeah, maybe bring me back once we have a decision.
Absolutely.